Okay. It says, next for me is to qualify briefly. I got 1 or 2 minutes. And, you know, basically I was just a hopeless drunk, state of mind drunk, you know. And I'm grateful I came in here at step two, the sanity in step two, that I created my own misery. And found a loving God in step three that stuck with me to cease fighting everything and everybody, you know. It said I had to. And, you know, I'm grateful for hanging in there whenever, you know, when I wanted to give up. You know, I've been in AA 30 and a half years. I drank 89 days. That's my track record. And, but I'm grateful I stayed. Everybody said, don't leave till the miracle happens. And I said, what miracle? You know? And so I stayed till the miracle happened, you know, and a new life did appear, you know, and, self-centeredness is a vicious thing. I've always said that. You know, it took me 3.5 years in this program to figure out self-centeredness. I knew it didn't take nobody that long here. And do something about it. You know, not until you see self-centeredness you're going to change. And see that self-righteousness, which is the heartbeat of self-centeredness. And the heartbeat of self-righteousness to me is jealousy. You know, and that led to all them resentments, you know. And then from there, you know, the low self-esteem comes in, you know. And not a very pretty thing, you know. But I'm grateful I found a way, you know. I come to these meetings. I went to my first AA meeting. This feeling was instilled in me, my first AA meeting. And it's still in there today, you know. And it's just a wonderful thing that where I came from, that I'm able to truly be so grateful for what A has done for me. Sorry, Pat. Okay. Chokes you up. And it's a good feeling, though, I'll tell you, to know that I have I come to this place, and every time I leave, I feel special. You know what I'm saying? So anyway, I'd like to introduce the speaker. My friend Robert. And the reason I chose Robert is because every time I come to an AA meeting, everything he has to say, I need to hear. And whether he knows that or not. But I'm grateful to be honored to present Robert to you. And you'll know what I'm talking about.
Hello, family. My name is Robert, and I am definitely an alcoholic.
Hey, Robert.
And, you know, I usually kid around with people that I used to be kind of bashful, but once I got through kindergarten, I was pretty good. You know, first, second grade was all right, but I'm really kind of nervous tonight, and I don't know why. I went on a little motorcycle ride today, so this is not alcohol in my face, okay? This is just sun. But, you know, Ray asked me about a week ago to come and share my story. I had the opportunity a couple years ago to share my story here. This is my home group. I think this is the best place that you can ever go to get sobriety, if that's what you really want. And, you know, the format's pretty simple. I've been to a lot of speaker meetings, and ideally what I'm going to try to do is tell you, you know, what my life was like, what happened, and what it's like today, you know. I don't want to spend all day telling you how sorry a drunk I was, because I think everybody in here knows how devastating we can be when we're at our lowest point, you know. But so for me, you know, I was the third son. I've got two older brothers and a younger sister. I was born and raised in Birmingham, Alabama, not Pittsburgh. You know, my real father was a raging alcoholic. As a little boy, I don't really have any fond memories of my real father, you know. And it's not like that I felt like I hated this man, but I just, there was never any kind of bond between a father and a son. And, you know, the only advantage that I did have is that my mother made up a lot of the difference between not having a real dad at home and having a mother that actually cared and loved for us like, you know, that you're supposed to be cared and loved for. And the reason I say that about my dad is because it left a big impression on me at a very young age that I never wanted to have anything to do with alcohol. My mother divorced my dad when I was 11, and then she remarried. I had a stepfather. When I was 11 years old, he took us from the projects of Birmingham, Alabama, and basically introduced me to more or less a middle-class way of living. I got involved in little league sports. I got involved in football, baseball, basketball, and started playing golf in high school. You hear it a lot of times, but even when I was doing good and things like that, I still didn't feel like I fit in, you know. And I know other people have heard that over and over, but that's the truth. I didn't feel like I fit in. My stepdad was a drinker, but the difference with him was I'm not going to say he was an alcoholic. I don't think he was. I think he was a heavy drinker, and it left a different impression on me. You know, at 11, 12 years old, we would leave Mobile, Alabama in his car and drive to Birmingham, and he's throwing down Budweisers and throwing them out the window, you know. Man, that was real appealing to an 11, 12-year-old boy, you know. So you can only imagine what happened when I turned 16. But this program is really, you know, they say that when you start getting your mind cleared out, that the fog, the spider webs kind of clear out and you get your memory back. I was about a year and a half in this program, and the best that I could recall, the first time I had a drink, I had fought the idea it was my sophomore year of high school, and I had two or three friends that kept prompting me to go drink. Let's go drink. Let's go drink. Out of respect for Alcoholics Anonymous, you know, I'm not going to dig too deep into some other things that I got into, but drugs are not foreign to me. There used to be a guy that chaired some meetings, used to talk about if you got a problem with bananas, you know, that we don't want to talk about bananas in here. And so I kind of use the word coconut. So, you know, when I say coconut, you're going to know what the hell I'm talking about. But anyway, I started out at about 16, 16 and a half, smoking weed, but I was sharing for about that first year that the first time I drank, I finally gave in to this one buddy of mine, and we were going to, you know, in Alabama, you had to be 21 to drink, but in Florida, you could be in 70, this was in 73, 74, and I know I don't look that old, but I am, but, you know, it was 30-something miles to the Florida line, and it was 15 miles to the Mississippi line. Well, you know, do the math, you know, we've only got 3 hours, so we were in Mississippi, you know, sneaking in, and that's what I thought was the first time I drank. And then I was in a meeting one night, and someone had shared about getting drunk and losing a job, and then it was like a flash hit. It was like, well, wait a minute, that's right, I was 15 and a half, I was getting off a school bus in front of the shop that my brother was running, we were detailing cars, and I was 15 and a half, and we were working, this one day was on a Saturday. And I went to a Whataburger with this little guy that my brother worked with, and we had a burger. And then he reached under, he was driving a 57 Ford Fairlane, I remember that. And he reached under the seat and he pulled out a bottle of some Thunderbird wine. And he said, "Roberts, you ought to try a slasher of this. This is pretty good, you know." I tried a slasher too and got back to work and basically got fired. My brother took one look at me and said, "What in the hell is wrong with you?" And nothing. Ain't nothing wrong with me. But he could smell the alcohol. And basically, that is actually the first time I drank. So the first time I drank, I lost the first job I ever had, too. You know. And you know what's kind of crazy about that? I got a daughter that about a year ago lost her first job. But I told her, I said, "Baby, it gets easier. I mean, you know, it's kind of tough the first time, but trust me, it gets easier." And, you know, and throughout my drinking career, I lost many a job, you know, and it was easier. But, you know, when I first started drinking, I can honestly tell you that not wanting to be an alcoholic, you know, the first probably 10 years of my drinking, I didn't have any problems. Life was good. You know, I could get in the car, pop the bud, run 100. I had a little Mustang, and it was throwing beer cans out the window. You know, I was reliving my stepdad's life. I never really had consequences. I was fairly good at achieving goals that I set. You know, now mind you, I set pretty low goals, but you know, that's because I'm a little guy. You know, I mean, hey, give me a break. But the bottom line is, throughout my drinking career, I have done probably everything anybody else has ever done, and probably worse. I'm going to hit on probably a couple of things to let you just know how sick I can be when I'm at my worst. In 1985, I was pretty bad on drinking Jack Daniels and coconuts. And I was married to my first wife, and we were drinking liquor, and we were messing with the coconuts. And basically, we run out of the coconuts, had to go get some more. When we came back, I did a little too much, and I OD'd, and technically I was dead for about a minute. And when I came to, my first wife was on me and beating on my chest. And I'll honestly tell you that I believe that God was with me when I was laying on that ground in 1985 and I was dead. And the reason that it was weird to me, it wasn't like there was a light at the end of the tunnel. There wasn't nothing like that, but I was laying there wondering, why can't I see nothing? You know, in my mind, my eyes are open. Now, this went on for a short period of time. But then when I came to, my first reaction was to shove her off and jump on her, and because I couldn't figure out why this woman's beating on me. And I think because of seeing a lot of ugliness, as my real dad used to beat my mother and slap us kids around, that I really can't explain it, but I didn't grab my wife, but I took about three steps and I jumped slap through a trailer window. Okay, I put 20-something stitches in the back of my head, and this was in June, and a neighbor came and grabbed me from behind. By then, I was tripping out of my mind on cocaine and the alcohol. Everything was, it was all whirling, and it took me 20 minutes to come down long enough for him to say, "Robert, man, you are screwed up." And Leon County Sheriff's going to be here in just a few minutes. And I came down enough that when the sheriff got there, he said, well, Mr. Bradford, what happened? And I says, well, I think I slipped in the kitchen and hit my head, you know. And, you know, there's all this glass laying all out in the yard and blood all around my car. I was trying to get in my car and leave and stuff like that. But made a long story short, he said, well, you need to go to the hospital because your head's cut pretty bad and this and that, you know. Well, being a very frugal alcoholic, I said, you know, I'm not paying for no damn ambulance ride. If I need to go, I'll go. And I got to the hospital, and then they told me they was going to shave my head to get all the glass out. I said, just do the best you can, because you can't tell now, but back in the day, I had some hair. And I damn sure didn't want to cut it off. But I quit messing with cocaine like that. After I finally, you know, got through with my stitches and stuff, I quit doing cocaine like I was doing. Like I say, I didn't really think I was an alcoholic, so an alcohol up to that point had never been a problem. You know, throughout my drinking career, I'll also tell you, I have what I call AMJA syndrome, and it's self-diagnosed. I have alligator mouth, jackrabbit ass syndrome. Okay? What that means is, at 140 pounds, if a 200-pound man tells me something I don't like, I ain't dealing with it. And, you know, I've created a lot of ass whoopings in that way. And, you know, the good news is, when you're drunk, you don't feel it as bad, I guess, you know, till the next day. But you know, that was probably the worst situation I had with my drinking. And then short of that, you know, after about 10 years, it just got to where it wasn't fun anymore. And at that time, I didn't know how to quit, you know. And I didn't really even think I had a problem with it. You know, I had my mother, my dad, and brothers and best friends telling me that, Robert, maybe you don't need to go out tonight, you know. But if it got dark, you know, I would only drink on special occasions. You know, if I was with somebody or by myself, or if it's light or dark outside. But even with that, I wasn't an alcoholic, because an alcoholic beat their wives, you know, and they sling their little kids around the room and stuff like that. So my perception, you know, wasn't exactly right. Me and my first wife were divorced basically because of the drinking, the drugging and stuff. You know, that was a bad time, because actually she had a daughter, and because of my behavior, I caused her to lose custody of her daughter. And you know, I wasn't proud of that. But the reality is, at that time, it didn't really faze me that much, you know, because, you know, I think Ray said a little something about being self-centered. You know, if it wasn't, you know, my immediate family, then, you know, I didn't really see a big deal in it. But I drank for another 10 or 15 years. I've lost, like, you know, I lost the first job I ever had when I drank, and I lost many more. But, and this is not, you know, I want to say welcome to the newcomer. You are the most important person in this room. And the people coming back, you know, welcome back, because there's never a guarantee that you can make it back in here, you know. I'm proud to say that I've only got one white chip here in Orlando. Okay, I got a bunch of them up in Tallahassee. I can't keep count of them. My math never was really one of my good strong suits, you know. I like history and physical education. But I guess I remarried about 8 years later. You know, I have this problem. I fall in love with women I can't stand. You know, I don't know what that's about. You know, everything's okay as long as they're listening to me and doing what I expect. But you know, when that other stuff ain't happening, it's just bad. But I married my second wife. We had a daughter, and for 12 years we fought and fussed and drank and did the things we do, and. In 99 we had a fight. She damn near beat me to death. And I always pick women meaner than me too. I don't know what that's about, but and I'm not making what I did right, but to get her off of me, I slapped her off of me. Well, you know, her friend didn't see her beating on me 20 times, but she sure saw me slap her off of me. And so when Leon County showed up, they said, "Mr. Bradford, how's it going?" Well, I was sitting on the porch then drinking my last beer because I knew what was fixing to happen. And sure enough, he put the cuffs on. We went down there, and he's like, "Mr. Bradford," he said, "most people come kicking and screaming in here." He said, "you seem to be pretty calm." I said, "that's pretty good." I said, "well, let's see, you know. I got my hands behind my back, and you got a gun, and you're about 220. I said, "ain't nothing here for me." But anyway, I got through the probation, and I got through all that. But as a result of that, Children and Family Services stepped in and took custody of my daughter. And my second wife was also an alcoholic, and she was at a battered women's center, and. Basically, she didn't come back. She left like the next day. She didn't come back. Well, Children and Family, I hooked up with them, and they put me through a program called Natural Bridge Recovery. It's in Woodville, Florida, south of Tallahassee, and you know, they let me go through the program so I could get my daughter back. You know, and man, I had, you talking about resentments, boy, them women, oh damn. I had resentments at them. I felt like, how in the hell can the government come in here and take my baby from me? You know, and you know, that broke my heart. You know, I can't say that I was a great dad, but I was a pretty good dad. You know, I was fairly functional as an alcoholic. You know, I went through all the years that I drank. I never got a DWI. Because back in my day, when you'd get pulled over, they wouldn't say, "have you been drinking?" You know, back in the late 70s, they say, "how many have you had?" You know, and I'd say two or three, and they'd look in the back seat, and "is there anybody else in there that can drive that hadn't been drinking?" I said, "oh no, they're all screwed up. You know, I can drive." And actually, one night I got a FHP followed me halfway from the party we was at, halfway to my house. He told me, he said, "if you cross that center line one time, son, you're going to jail." And I'm like, "not a problem." So I drove home. I got about halfway home. I seen him whip it around. He took off back to the party. But you know, I knew that that things were getting pretty bad. But like you say, I mean, 5:30 would roll around. You know, I could piss and moan all the way to about 5:15. But damn, 5:30, no matter how hungover I was, and I swear up and down, I'm not going to drink today. But I don't. It's something about 5:30 for me, you know. And I'd get off work, and it'd start with one beer, and you know, I'm only going to have one or two, you know, because I'm not alcoholic like most y'all guys in here probably. But that's not the case, you know. I I could get tore up one night and I might not drink for another week. So I thought, well, that means I'm not an alcoholic, you know. But basically what I found out after I started coming to these rooms is that, you know, I could stop drinking for a while, but I couldn't stay stopped, you know. And the reality for me is that that's kind of when I started feeling like I fit in, you know. I mean, I wasn't a blackout drinker, you know. I was a knockout drinker, you know. We get in an argument, somebody knocks me out, you know, not a big deal. I mean, you know, if they didn't knock me out, I'd just stay on the ground, you know. I mean, damn. But I made it through Natural Bridge Recovery Center in 99, and I went through the program, and you know, I'll be honest, there was two or three of these steps that I really liked, and I could see them working in my life, you know. I number one wasn't one of them, but you know, humbly asking God to help me out and all that kind of stuff, I was already pretty good at that. You know, every time I would get in the trenches, I'd ask Him, and I'm still here, so He must have done something to keep me going. But toward the very end, you know, I had 18 months clean. But I think that first year, I think I really, really was working the program. Maybe not the best I could, but I was working the program, and I put a little weight on, and I was looking pretty good, and got my job back, and got custody of my daughter, and they helped me. They put me in an apartment. They were bending over backwards because, you know, basically they want to take care of the children. That's what it's about. And then, you know, I got a little ahead of myself. You know, I was doing four or five meetings a week. And, you know, well, that slacked off to, you know, two or three. And then finally, toward the end, I was chairing a Wednesday night meeting up in Tallahassee. And I felt, well, I'm chairing a meeting. That ought to be good enough. But on a Friday, I got a call from my ex. Well, at that time, she wasn't my ex. But on a Friday, let's go to dinner, you know. And there's certain things that goes with dinner that, you know, I was very interested in. And I drank a beer on a Friday, and you know, we did the little fool around thing. And then I made it back home. I was like, damn, I can only have one beer, you know. I this is all right. I think I can handle this, you know. Next Friday rolled around, I got another phone call. Hey, you want a dinner again, you know. Man, are you kidding? Sure. Well, I had two beers that Friday, and, you know, played the little game, and now, shit, I am the man. I can drink two beers, I can do whatever I want, and that next Friday rolled around, and it was three beers, and I was calling the coconut man. And that was after 18 months, not counting the previous 2 weeks, and I got so tore up that I didn't make it home, and I don't know for a fact, but I think my sister-in-law called Children and Family Services again. And when I got home, there was two police and a representative for DCF was there. And basically, they took my daughter away. And that broke my heart, you know. The only thing that I was proud of in my life was that me and my daughter really had a good relationship, you know. And when that happened, I went off the deep end. I started my drinking and the other things that I was doing, just it was every day, every night. It was all I could do. And that went on for 2 years. And my daughter was placed in foster care for a few months until her aunt stepped up, which her aunt on her mother's side. And she was a very functional lady. She wasn't an alcoholic. She drank a little, but basically she took care of my daughter. And for 2 years, all I did was piss and moan about how sorry life was and how can they do this to me and the whole bit. But in October of 85, my stepfather was diagnosed with lung cancer. And I started going to the rooms again, you know, and I would go to meetings. Some weeks I'd go every day. Sometimes I could go two or three days without a drink, sometimes a week or so, but I'm just going to be as honest as I can. You know, I had a guy sharing here one night. He says that my opinion can't change the facts, but the facts can change my opinion. And And the fact was that, you know, I had lost her. It was all my doing. And but when the cancer thing hit, I was trying to get clean, but I was not strong enough to go to work, come home, go to a meeting, and go home. I wasn't man enough. I wasn't big enough, bad enough. I could not do it, you know. And so the people in here that can come in here, and they're not court ordered, and you don't have children and family pushing you to do it, you know, my hat's off to you, because I couldn't do it. You know, I was too weak. And but I really, really wanted to get clean, you know. And you know, those last, my stepdad was told in October that he probably wouldn't make it to Christmas. And my brother drove over in October and told me, he was the one that told me about it. And me and him proceeded to get drunk. And my brother actually got a DWI on the way home from my house that night. And as I watched my father go through this lung cancer, I was losing my mind. All he wanted to do was take care of my mother. And all I wanted to do was try to get clean, and I couldn't. And towards the end, I was going to see my parents. I was going to see my dad every Sunday. We were painting. We were doing everything we could to get the house in order, which wasn't a whole lot. It's a pretty nice house. But whatever he wanted me to do, I would do. And then on a Friday, I was told the next to last Sunday that I saw my dad alive, I was told that hospice was going to bring the bed in. You'd think you'd get used to it. But when they told me that, I lost it. They told me that on the Sunday I was there, that Sunday. And then the following Thursday, I mean that following Sunday, when I saw him in that bed, that's when the switch went off in my head, and I was not going to quit drinking. I was not going to quit doing anything. And I wanted to be dead. I truly was not strong enough to put a gun to my head, but I just wanted to pull the trigger and be done. And I really believe that God intervened then, because you know it says as a result of these steps we get a spiritual awakening. I put my head on a steering wheel when I was trying to get back home after I'd partied for 4 days, and I'd say, God, either put me in jail, put me in recovery, or just take me away because I don't want to be here no more. I had become a worthless father, brother, son, worker, everything, you know. And I had a friend that I had done more drinking and drugging with than anybody on this planet come and pick me up. He looked at me and he said, Robert, what do you want to do about your problem? You know, usually he says, how much money have you got, and have you got any more beer? You know. And he took me to detox, and he made all the plans, and that's how I got to Orlando. All I did was say, yeah, I need to go to detox. That lady asked me, did I want to hurt myself? I said, no. I says, but I just don't want to wake up, you know. They put me on lithium, I think, for 2 days, and shit, after 2 days of that, I was done with that shit. I like the stuff that gets you up, but I don't like the stuff that wants to put you down. And you know, after that, I got out. I went to see my dad in the hospice bed. And I know as an alcoholic, even though at that time I didn't think I was, that I couldn't promise him that I would never drink, but I promised my dad I'm going to do everything I can to never drink again. That's the promise I made him. And this was May of 06. My sobriety date is May the 22nd of 2006. You know, that's not very important to anybody in here. It means a whole hell of a lot to me. But the only day that really matters right now is this one we're sitting in. And, you know, I came in here, I went to the Salvation Army, and I started working these steps, and that's when my life started changing. You know, the Salvation Army, they have at that time, they had more or less a 12-step scenario set up. And you got to be there for 30 days before you get to go out on your first meeting. And so I was actually through step one and two through them. I started coming here to Central, and I cried every meeting I came to. And I sat next to a lady that had lost her husband 6 months before that. And I had another friend in here that lost a brother that either got killed or suicide, I don't know. But they both kept him and says, Robert, we don't drink no matter what, you know. And everything that I'm going to tell you from this point on is nothing that's came from my brain. It's from everybody sitting in here. I can look through here and I can see so many people that have helped me along the way, even if you never know it. Because most of the time when I go to meeting, I get something I need. And whether I come up and tell you or not, it doesn't matter, because I need to get what I need so that I don't drink. Because I don't ever want to drink again. But when I started working these steps, I was going to ask this guy named California Rob to be my sponsor. And he was speaking one night. And I was sitting on the picnic table waiting on him to come out. And this big old dude, about 300 pounds, come up, bald-headed weightlifter, comes out. And he starts talking to two guys, you know. And I'm kind of eavesdropping and listening and watching for Rob. And after I heard this guy talk to these guys for about 5 minutes, I looked at him and said, damn, I said, can you be my sponsor, you know? And he said, yeah. He asked me, so you believe in God? I said, yeah, you know. And he started working with him. My sponsor's name is Jerry Vest, and I love that man. And he helped change my life. Everybody in here has, but those first, probably, you know, they say do 90 meetings in 90 days. I thought about drinking every day for probably about a month and a half. And then it dawned on me one day. I got up one day and I was like, damn, I ain't thought about drinking in a while. You know, man, I felt good. But then it was like, damn, I thought about it for another 4 or 5 days. But you know, the bottom line was, that's when the obsession for me to drink got lifted. And you know, May the 22nd was a very important day. But the greatest day of my life was the day I got up and I didn't think about drinking. And I can't tell you what the day was, but it was July or early August, I don't know. And it's not important, because right now I don't have the desire to drink. I hardly ever do. But when I do, I know what I have to do. I need to come and talk to somebody. You know, I was the kind of guy that would stand and look out a window. If I got mad, I'd stand at the window for 2 hours looking at it. Even as a little kid, my mom would say, what's wrong? Nothing. You know? And, you know, that shit don't work. I mean, and I've come through. When I started working the steps, then Jerry was like, all right, we got to do 4, and then we got to do 5, and we got to start working on number 4, because if you already got left Tallahassee to come here, you're already pretty sure you're an alcoholic, and you admitted, you know, you came to believe, you believe in God. You know, my mother, she wanted me to be a Southern Baptist gentleman, you know. Well, shit, I'm still Southern. 1 out of 3 ain't bad. But I had always believed in God, you know. I always believed in God, but I never fit in. I went to church as a little kid, you know. I go right in the front door, right out the back door, you know. The first year or two I didn't, but the guy would be talking about the fire and brimstone, and when you die, you're a heathen and you're going to hell, you know. And he always seemed to be looking at me and my two brothers. I don't know what that was about. Either he had a bad eye, I don't know. But he had me going. And that's about when I started going out the back door. But I started writing down my 4th step. And Jerry, after a couple of weeks, he said, Robert, you about ready, ain't you? I said, Jerry, I am so close, buddy. Another day or two, I am there, you know. Some people in here procrastinate about some of this stuff, but I wasn't. I was seriously putting my heart and soul in it. Yeah. But anyway, so we were going to do it on a Tuesday. He says, all right. He says, we'll do it next Tuesday. And he called me up next Tuesday. Robert, now we're ready now, right? Jerry, I mean, almost. I mean, one more day maybe. He says, I says, I am so close you wouldn't believe it. He says, well, I'm pretty damn close too. I'm in the parking lot. Bring your little bony ass out here and we're going to go do this. So we got in the truck and we took off. And to start it out, he started telling me some of the things that he had discussed in his 4th step, you know. And he had always told me, he said, if it's got a name to it, somebody's already done it, you know. And I was kind of scared about telling him some of the stuff I'd done. All of it had names, you know. And then he started telling me shit that didn't have names, and I was like, wow. I knew that I wasn't the sickest puppy in the car. And so I basically opened up and I told him all the things I needed to do. But I do remember one thing he told me that last time he called me. He said, Robert, he said, if you got to stay up at night thinking about what you're going to write down, he said, in the first place, I don't care. He says, what you need to write down is the stuff that keeps you up all night, the stuff you cry about all day long that will never leave your mind. That's what we're going to start on. And so that's what we did. We started on that. And you know, I didn't get a great relief from it that first night, but over the next few days I realized that, you know, I did start feeling better about myself. You know, I didn't feel like I was worthless anymore. And I started riding a bicycle from Central down here. And you know, they say that first year is like the pink cloud year. My cloud was pinker than anybody else's cloud in here. Because when you get to ride a bicycle away from 95 other guys that you got to stand in line behind to get everything done, life was good. My own sidewalk, my own red lights. I had my own meeting place. And back when I first started coming here, the walls was colored garnet and gold. And I ain't bringing that up for any special reason, but you know, being a Seminole and all, I sure felt home. I thought maybe they'd done that for me. I don't know. But then, you know, I started working on the amends, and I'll be honest with you, you know, the ones that I thought was going to be easy, they were hard, you know. And the ones that I was putting off till last were the ones that really worked out to be the easiest. And those were the ones with mostly family and relatives that really only wanted to see me doing good anyway, you know. And there's still a lot of amends I can't make because geographically I'm here, and most of my amends are, you know, 250 miles up, but I'm still willing, you know, and that's what it says. You have to be willing to make amends wherever possible. And this program has worked in my life. You know, I've made a lot of amends. My first Thanksgiving and Christmas was pretty rough. You know, I wasn't able to make it back home. And I think even if I had it probably would have been bad because my mother was not wanting to do Christmas, or, you know, that went on for 3 years. But Jerry got up with me and we were taking leftover food to the homeless people. And I tell you, that got me out of myself, you know. And I started chairing a Wednesday meeting after my first couple years. And I'll tell you what, I learned how to listen in these rooms, you know. My attention span is probably about 20 seconds. You know, if you start talking to me, I'm listening up to about 20 seconds, and then my mind is way somewhere else. And that's even now sometimes. But when you chair a meeting, it seems like they're always looking at you. You know, they're sharing, they've got looking around, but they're right back to you, you know. And so, damn, you got to listen, you know. But I learn a lot. I learn a lot from everybody in here, you know. And, you know, things were going real good, you know. 2007, I got a job at the Greenway Ford, you know, making good money again. You know, life was going pretty good. And then I remember the day I had one mechanic in particular. I could get out of my car and be just so serene. I'd get to work right before the sun would come up. And it's a blue sky and it's purple and it's red. Me and God are hooked up. And I'm going to work. And I'd get about 10 foot from the door. I said, damn, if that guy says something to me, I'm going to snap his ass. And that went on and that went on. And I kept praying, God, help me get through this. It's just one mechanic, a little young guy, about 22, used to bite my ass to deal with him. And anyway, I kept praying on it. I got to work one day and I got a 100% pay cut. And now I wasn't fired. Now I've been fired a bunch, but I actually got laid off and I collected unemployment for 99 weeks, the best 2 years of my life. I'm like, you know, I'm not a lazy man, but the check was in the mail. And I did those 2 years. I doubled up on meetings. I really grew a lot from 99. Well, you know, not this way, but you know, inside. But my life today, it looks nothing like what I thought it was going to look like. You know, and I know I need to hurry. But you know, we talk about the promises in this program. You know, and we're not a glum lot. You know. There's a lot of meetings I go to and there's a lot of sadness, but you know what? I believe what Ray said. Every time I come to a meeting when I'm feeling bad about something or indifferent or whatever, I always feel better when I leave. I feel better when I walk in the door. And I don't know if that's true for all you guys, but I truly do. And the God thing, if God scares you, you know, don't worry about it. You know, the alcohol will run you back in here if you have that opportunity. I did get my daughter back, and after my second year clean, I started trying to work with her to get her back, and that that, well, actually the first year, that first year she wasn't ready, and damn, that broke my heart, you know. By then she was in Washington State and I'm in Orlando, and it just, you know, it was hard. That's the only thing I wanted. And the next year I went to visit her for a few days, and then I got back, and she came to stay with me a few months after that for Christmas, and 10 days after that, I'm a diagnosed crybaby too, okay? I'm sorry. But anyway, 10 days after that, she called. She was ready to come home. Now, with that being said, be careful what you pray for, okay? Why in the hell I thought I could raise a 17-year-old girl is far beyond me. But you know what? I didn't do it alone. You know, I've got several women, you know, it says guys for guys, women for women. But, you know, when I got female problems, I need to talk to a female, you know. And when you get a 17-year-old daughter living in your house, you got female problems, okay? Now, my daughter turned 21 in June, just last month, and you know, that's been a lot of stress on me, you know. Now I'm going through the empty nest syndrome, you know. And damn, that sucks, you know. You know, but, you know, I wouldn't change it for the world. My life, you know, I get up every day, I feel good. I really do. You know, and when I go to bed every night that I've been in this program, I feel good when I go to bed. Well, let me take that back. Except for the nights when I was in an argument with somebody that I didn't do an amends with before I went to sleep, I feel pretty good. But I have gotten pretty good at doing my amends as quick as I can. I guess I'll say one more thing that I want to leave with you. You know, I think that the most precious thing you can give somebody in here is your time. You know, we put time on a scale, and it's usually a pay scale, and it's how much money can I get for how much time do you want? But I had a sponsor that went out of his way to come pick me up, drive me around, and take me to meetings and do things with me. You know, he loved me unconditionally. I couldn't give him anything back. I'm living at the Salvation Army with 95 men. You know, if I was to have had to hit the street because of relapsing or something, I'd have maybe two bags full of clothes. But the most valuable thing you can give somebody is your time, you know. And I think for me, that's the importance of the sponsorship, because it's hard to tell a whole crowd all of your sick stuff, you know. But you find that one person, or you find somebody that you can unload, because the only way for a guy like me to stay in the present so that I can be around in the future is to get rid of that past, you know. I truly believe that when I started this program, I've got a new history. And my new history looks a whole lot better than that old history. But that old history can serve its purpose too, because, you know, if I was to sit up here and tell you, well, I drank a couple of times, but then I came in and I got okay, you'd think, you know, well, that wasn't so hard to do. But, you know, today I have focus. I have the ability to push the pause button. I've learned a lot, you know. I don't have to show up for every ass whooping I'm invited to, you know. You can hit pause. Let's think about this a minute, Robert. Do you really want to go there? Not really, you know. And most of the fights I have today are with a 21-year-old girl who thinks she knows more than me. And the reality is, she probably does. But she's not here, so I'm not admitting it. You know, that's just how that goes, you know. But, you know, like I say, if you're new, please just, you know, give it your best shot, you know. And if you don't even think it's your best shot, just keep giving it a shot. Because there's days that I get up and I don't feel like all this spiritual growth. And I don't feel, you know, we all have days like that. I've shared before. I said, when I'm having a day that I feel like I'm going to end up making amends to somebody, I just stay home, you know. Pick a movie, get on my bike, go ride, get sun on your face, do something or call somebody or do something, you know. The most important thing I have in my toolbox is phone numbers. Because I never would tell nobody how I was feeling. You know, okay ain't a feeling, you know. But when I feel like crying, I cry. When I feel like laughing, I laugh, you know. But even with that, I need to tell somebody, because I would celebrate for any reason, or I could, you know, be down in the dumps with you for any reason. So I just, you know, like you say, it's just one day at a time. And today's the only important one, you know. And I didn't wake up today till 12 o'clock. So if y'all got up earlier than that, you got more sobriety than me today. Thank you.